let Obamacare fail, and then everybody's going to have to come together and fix it and come up with a new plan, and a plan that's really good for the people, with much lower premiums, much lower costs, and much better protection. I've been saying that, Mike, I think you'll agree, for a long time. Let Obamacare fail. It'll be a lot easier. And I think we're probably in that position where we'll just let Obamacare fail. We're not going to own it. I'm not going to own it. I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. We'll let Obamacare fail, and then the Democrats are going to come to us, and they're going to say, how do we fix it? How do we fix it? Or how do we come up with a new plan?
President Donald Trump lamenting the failure of the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare, and even just repeal and replace later. Today, three senators rejected Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's Hail Mary of just repealing now and replacing sometime in the future. And so after nearly a decade of campaigning against the health law, Senate Republicans appear unable to make good on their promise to get rid of Obamacare. Joining us now is Noam Levy. He covers health care for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And here to talk about how the Republican Party recovers from this politically is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
McConnell is now reverting back to what became known as the repeal and delay strategy. He wants to repeal Obamacare with a two-year delay. Here is Senator Susan Collins of Maine, one of three Republicans who are saying that's not going to fly.
I do not think that it is going to be constructive to repeal a law that at this point is so interwoven within our healthcare system, and then hope that over the next 2 years we will come up with some kind of replacement. I think that would create great anxiety.
Okay, so Noam, McConnell says even though this idea is doomed, he's going to hold a vote anyway. What's his calculation?
Well, I think Leader McConnell has to demonstrate, particularly to the conservative wing of the Republican Party, that he has done everything in his power to try to advance the preferred alternative of the preferred Republican alternative, which has always been to repeal as much of the Affordable Care Act as possible right now and deal with replacement later. And if he wants to move beyond health care, and I think there are some indications that that may be what he wants to do to get to other issues, he has to show that there wasn't anything left on the field, so to speak.
Hmm. And Rich, is this just political cover for McConnell?
Yeah, well, I think he wants to let members who want to have the vote have the vote, and he wants to show up, really, those members who voted for a December 2015 bill that was repeal only, and there are only two Republicans who voted against it, Susan Collins, who's maintained a no, and Mark Kirk is no longer in the Senate. So a big part of the problem here for Republicans has been a lot of their members were acting in bad faith. They were willing to repeal Obamacare so long as it was only a symbolic vote, and they knew that President Obama would reliably veto it. Now that there's a president who actually signed it, they have a different attitude. And then there's another structural problem, which is that there's a faction of the party that doesn't want to really repeal Obamacare, and there's a faction of the party that doesn't want to really replace Obamacare. So if you try to advance a repeal and replace bill, that means you're going to have some problems, and we've seen that play out dramatically the last couple months.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear from House Speaker Paul Ryan. Today he kind of threw Senate Republicans under the bus for not getting the bill passed. Here's him taking questions from reporters.
And so we're hopeful that the Senate can take the pause that they need to take and move forward on this issue so we can get something done.
But are you worried that repealing...
Well, I'm worried that this law... I'm worried that Obamacare will stand and the law will continue to collapse and people will get hurt in the process.
President Trump, on the other hand, said Republicans should let the law collapse. And so, Noam, how divided is the Republican Party on the way forward right now when it comes to health care?
Oh, I think very divided. You know, there are, as Rich said, a wing of the party that wants to repeal all of this bill. And there are a number of Republican senators, particularly, although they're members of the House of Representatives as well, many Republican governors, who worry that a repeal or even a repeal and replace of the kind that Leader McConnell was advocating would be devastating for millions of American patients, particularly poor people, particularly people with pre-existing medical conditions. So This rift within the Republican Party was largely papered over, I think, while President Obama was in office and while the party didn't have to reckon with the real-world consequences of some of its rhetoric. Now, of course, there is no escape from that as Republicans control all the branches of government.
How would it work just letting it fall apart? Is that even possible, that Obamacare would fall apart on its own?
Yes and no. So there is, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, some instability in insurance markets around the country. There are parts of the country where the number of choices for consumers who buy insurance on their own has become increasingly limited. That's put additional pressure on premiums as well. The full-scale collapse of the law is unlikely, and I think it's important to note that the marketplaces that have garnered the most attention here serve about 10 million Americans, whereas Medicaid, for example, the safety net program for poor Americans, serves 70-plus million. There's not much indication that that particular system is in any immediate jeopardy, nor is there any indication that the employer-based system that serves more than half of Americans is in any jeopardy. But these marketplaces are significant, and there is a feeling among folks in the insurance industry as well as independent experts that steps should be taken, could be taken, to help stabilize those markets and to ensure that people who rely on them would be able to find affordable health insurance options.
But let's talk about the Medicaid part of that, Rich, because today the House unveiled its budget proposal, and there are big cuts to Medicaid. So couldn't Obamacare and the healthcare system, I should say in general, could it be changed through the budgetary process and leaving aside a separate healthcare bill?
Yeah, in theory, I think what they probably try to do now is just focus on the Senate on the things that they agree on. They all agree on repealing the individual mandate. They all agree on relaxing some of these so-called age bans in Obamacare. They agree somewhat on a few deregulatory steps. Do that and then see what they can do going forward, perhaps through the budget, you know, changes to Medicaid and Medicare. But from where I stand as a conservative limited to government guy, the collapse of this bill is just another sign that it's extremely difficult and nearly impossible to reform the entitlement state, because the changes to Medicaid are, if you're ever going to reform entitlement, it's how you need to do it. You don't do it right away, put it off for several years, and then you just change the funding formula to slightly slow the growth rate of growth over time, and that even that is radioactive for Republican office holders. Just speaks to just how difficult it is to change any government program once it's set underway.
Did you mean Medicare?
Medicaid.
Medicaid, okay. And leaving aside also Medicare as an entitlement as well, there are cuts to that in this budgetary proposal as well.
Yes, and the problem there, in addition to the one I just the universal one I just alluded to, is no one's made the case. You know, President Trump didn't campaign on reforming Medicare. In fact, the opposite. So if you just up and try to do it in this budget, it's probably going to be very, very difficult, having built no consensus for it whatsoever. And finally, just on this health care bill, it really suffered from the fact that no one made the case for it. President Trump wasn't versed enough on the policy to make the case for it, to negotiate for it in private, or to make the case for it, you know, nationally and campaign around the country for it and give speeches about it. And McConnell and Ryan didn't even attempt to do that at all. It was largely a inside game and often a secret game. So no one made the case for it, and this bill, according to, you know, three or four reputable polls, had support in the teens, and it's just very hard to pass anything like that in the teeth of public opposition.
Mm. Well, so in a weird way, are they kind of breathing a sigh of relief?
I don't think so. Some of them are, but I think they're in a situation where the politics were lose-lose. The bill was going to be unpopular if they passed it, and they would have owned the entire system. But not having, not doing anything after talking about it for 7 years, after voting to repeal it in December 2015 when they knew they're firing kind of with empty ammunition, is going to be really dispiriting to the base. So I don't see either being a great scenario.
Noam, what about the Democrats? There is some indication that some may want to work on a bipartisan effort with Republicans to fix some of the problems with the exchanges. How likely is that?
I mean, I think it's an open question right now. I think some Democrats are genuinely interested in doing that, particularly from states where the marketplaces have been under greater strain. The question, I think, actually is more whether Republicans are willing to do that. I think the party is at a place right now where I don't think it really knows what to do on health care. The bill that the House produced and that the Senate produced not only was unpopular with voters, it drew almost universal condemnation from anybody who knew anything about health care. Physicians groups, patient advocates, hospitals, even health insurers said that the bill simply would not work, that they would leave millions of Americans without health insurance, that they would do very little to control costs except for essentially rationing people's access to medical care. That's not a policy prescription that works from a practical standpoint. It obviously had huge political problems for Republicans as well. So I think Republicans have to sort of decide what it is that they want to do on health care if, as Rich suggests, that there should be greater focus on constraining the growth of government programs like Medicaid and Medicare. That's one discussion that may be worth having. The federal government spends an enormous amount of money on health care, and Republicans traditionally have had an interest in trying to restrain that. That wasn't where this debate was. There was, frankly, a pretty dishonest effort by the Trump administration and by a number of congressional Republicans to pretend that what the Senate and House bills would do would not, in fact, jeopardize people's health coverage, would not jeopardize people's access to health care. In the midst of that level of chaos and sort of policy disjointedness, it's hard to see where Republicans are going. They're the ones who are going to have to decide whether or not they're willing to reach across the aisle, settle for something that's less than full or even major repeal of Obamacare, and whether or not they can live with some more incremental changes to Medicaid or the marketplaces or even Medicare, changes that may move the sort of nation's healthcare system slightly rightward, rather than swinging it dramatically as these bills were going to do. I think it's a big open question whether or not President Trump, Leader McConnell, or Speaker Ryan has the capacity to navigate that very difficult path through Republican politics in the coming months and years.
Yeah. And so, Rich, big picture view now, we've got about a minute left. Is this a problem with this particular piece of legislation or healthcare in general that Republicans, as you've said, are pretty weak when it comes to coming up with healthcare legislation? Or is this a failure of a bigger failure, a symptom of a larger problem within the Republican Party?
It's both. One, Republicans don't really care about healthcare, and they hadn't taken the care to think through very carefully what their alternative would be. You can kind of see what that vision is in broad gauge, and some Republican walks have explained it in great detail, but the average Republican office holder, does he know what that vision is and believe in it and can defend it? Probably not. And then one of the problems that beset this bill, that the president couldn't be very engaged substantively, and then it couldn't really lead the Congress, and it's like herding cats in the best of circumstances, meant that the forces pulling in various directions never cohered, and that's a scenario that's likely to adhere also on tax reform. Now, I think that they'll be very motivated to do at least something on taxes, and it's much easier to cut taxes than to do what they're trying to do on health care. So I think they'll get something on taxes, but it won't be the generational kind of reform of the system they've been talking about.
Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the LA Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think of the Republicans' failure to make good on their promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act will hurt them in next year's elections? You can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the R&B singer R. Kelly is accused of running a cult made up of young women whom he strictly controls. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And just a warning, this next story has some very sensitive issues in it. And so if you have young children listening, maybe turn down the volume. The R&B star R. Kelly is running an abusive cult and holding young women against their will, their parents say. These allegations come in a BuzzFeed report, a new investigation by journalist Jim DeRogatis. DeRogatis has been following R. Kelly's career and legal issues for years, since before his trial and acquittal on child pornography charges nearly 10 years ago, and he joins me now. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Thank you, Madeline.
Well, begin, if you would, by describing what the women in your story say about how they're treated by R. Kelly.
Well, I spoke to two sets of parents in Georgia and in Florida whose daughters are 18 and 21, and three women who were brave enough to speak on the record and use their names. The parents were on the record as well, but we did not in BuzzFeed yesterday use their names so as not to invade the privacy of their daughters. That these women are six or seven at a time, housed by Kelly half the time in a guest house he is renting around the corner from a mansion he rents in Atlanta suburbs. And then the other half of the time he lives in Trump Tower in Chicago and rents a recording studio near Union Park where the girls are held when he's in residence here. The girls are told, the women are told, some of them range in age to late 20s, early 30s, but the youngest are 18 and 21. They're told when to eat, when to sleep, when to bathe, if they can watch TV, to dress in baggy jumpsuits, jogging suits, because he doesn't want his male friends to see their form, to turn and face the wall when any male friend enters the room. They have to knock before entering any room in these houses, ask permission to leave a room, and how to pleasure him sexually in encounters that he records.
Okay, so
and they're hit. They're physically punished and mentally abused if they break any of these rules. Their cell phones are taken from them, and they are issued new cell phones that he gives them that are to be used only to contact him or others with his permission.
So they can't contact their parents or their friends or anyone.
There's been minimal contact with the parents in Georgia or Florida over the last year and year and a half. Yes.
So basically, are they sex slaves?
The words that the parents and the three sources on the record use are brainwashed and cult. I'm not going to characterize it, but the words that these parents use and one of the women who was in a sexual relationship with Kelly as part of this living arrangement, they say cult and brainwashed.
Okay, in your story, you have an audio recording of one of the girls, or one woman. She's 21 years old. Her name is Joycelyn. And
yeah, she's come out since, and their parents, her parents have held a press conference in front of one of the houses, and the woman we spoke to on the record, Asante McGee, joined them.
Okay, I just want to play a little snippet of this phone conversation that she is having. She's an aspiring singer. This is a phone conversation that she had between her and R. Kelly.
I'm even more interested in developing you. Songs are not an issue. You can always do a hit song. You can always do a great song. That's good.
Right.
Okay, so he says, I'm more interested in developing you. Songs are not an issue. We can always do a hit song. We can always do a great song.
It's part of a larger recording that sort of lays out how Kelly could seduce a young woman who's dreaming of stardom. She's an incredibly talented singer. So is the 18-year-old from Florida. And the parents had this recording and passed it along to BuzzFeed. And it's whenever she tries to talk about music, the subject is turned in a very disturbing way to the lewdest kind of sexual talk.
So do these girls or young women go voluntarily to his house? How did they get there in the first place?
You know, in both cases, the parents were trying to encourage their daughters' singing careers. And they were aware of the allegations against Kelly in the past. This is a man who was tried and acquitted on making child pornography. But there's a long string of civil lawsuits that are part of the public record of young women who sued Kelly after he pursued illegal sexual relationships with them. In some cases, the women attempted suicide when the relationships ended. There's the Aaliyah reporting. This is reporting I've done since 2000. Much of it was through the trial was for the Chicago Sun-Times, and not a word the Sun-Times ever published in a decade of reporting was subject to a lawsuit, retraction, or correction. So as with BuzzFeed, the Chicago Sun-Times stood behind every word we published. Obviously, BuzzFeed does with what we published yesterday. And there's a context here. This is not happening in a vacuum. This is not a one-day scandal. It's part of a pattern of behavior, 2.5 decades old, that, you know, of him allegedly hurting young African-American women.
So just in this particular instance, the parents thought, well, if we're around and we're shepherding these meetings, everything will be okay. They heard about the trial. They've heard about the allegations against R. Kelly, but they think that they can provide a buffer, and somehow he gets around them.
The relationships began without the parents knowing that their daughters were continuing to talk to him and text him. And in some cases, the daughters lied when he would fly them out to concerts. And then eventually they stopped coming home and all contact was broken off, aside from an occasional text that the daughters, that the parents believe Kelly was looking over their shoulders. The one text came on Mother's Day to the Georgia mom, who's now named herself. Her name is Jay Savage, and it said, "Happy Mother's Day from me and Rob."
Okay, I'm going to play a clip.
She has not seen her daughter since December.
Let me play a clip of tape from the sister of Joycelyn. You mentioned this press conference. Here is a clip from it.
What R. Kelly has done to you, nobody needs to go through what you've been through and what them other girls been through. I love my sister so much, and I just want to see her how she used to be. When Joycelyn left to go to college, everything changed after that. Everything. And it's all because of this monster, R. Kelly.
So last night, Joycelyn spoke with TMZ in a video chat. She said she was not being held against her will. She was totally fine.
That's what she told police when they made well-being checks at the recording studio in Chicago and at the guest house in Georgia. The parents respond to that by saying she's brainwashed and this is Stockholm syndrome. That's the parents talking. I'm not characterizing this. We can say, you know, that Joycelyn is saying she wants to be there. But all of the sources in the BuzzFeed story are reporting a pattern of mental and physical abuse. If you break the rules, Daddy, they are all forced to call Kelly Daddy, has laid out, and you dare to talk to a man or you disobey any of the rules, he punishes them physically. This is on-the-record allegations from young women who were brave enough to put their names to him.
So that is something that law enforcement could investigate. That's assault.
You know, I can't comment on that. I can say that right now, police in Georgia, Florida, and Illinois have been unable to help. But I can tell you that the parents who gave the press conference yesterday, the Savages, have also been interviewed by the FBI, which will not confirm nor deny an ongoing investigation.
Well, meanwhile, he has collaborated with people like Lady Gaga, Ty Dolla Sign, Lil Wayne.
Celine Dion.
Yeah, he's been on The Tonight Show in December.
He was on The Tonight Show singing Christmas songs from his latest album on December 23rd and getting a big old bear hug from Jimmy Fallon. And the only other time that the Joy's parents have heard from her was a text on Christmas Day saying, "I'm sorry, Christmas has to be this way this year."
So, I mean, as a culture, it's kind of like Bill Cosby, that people are ignoring this
until... Well, Madeline, I tell you, you know, the fact that RCA Records continues to have him at the top of their roster, the fact that Live Nation, the largest concert promoter in the world, is promoting his concerts this summer. He's on The Tonight Show. He's endorsing the Alexander Wang fashion line. He's recording music with Lady Gaga, a champion of female empowerment. You know, I think that the music industry and entertainment journalists have turned a blind eye for a very long time to a 2.5-decade pattern of behavior that allegedly has left many young African-American women devastated in his wake. And those include not just women we haven't met, but women like Aaliyah. He married Aaliyah illegally under a falsified marriage license when she was 15. He falsified the marriage license and said she was 18. They were separated almost immediately thereafter and never saw each other again. You know, it had an impact on her life as well. This has been happening pretty much in full view of the world. Let me remind you that marriage to Aaliyah happened right after he wrote every song and produced everything on her debut album, which was issued under the title he gave it, Age Ain't Nothing But a Number.
All right, Jim, thank you so much. Thank you for your reporting.
It's not a pleasant story to talk about, but I think
but an important one.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Jim DeRogatis. He's a reporter for BuzzFeed and co-host of the public radio show Sound Opinions on WBEZ in Chicago. And we'd like to hear from you. Has your opinion of R. Kelly changed over the years? Do you think being a fan of his music is a de facto endorsement of his offstage activities? You can comment on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, something much more pleasant. What you should read next, highbrow and lowbrow recommendations from KCRW's Bookworm.
We know something's going to happen. Something's going to happen to someone, but we don't know when or to who or why. And everything turns into a huge romp, an enormous surprise.
Michael Silverblatt joins us with two book reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Summer is here, which means a lot of time spent lounging poolside and oceanside. And if you're looking for a book to bring with you, we here at KCRW's Press Play are here to help. We also know that books, just like people who read them, are all different and open to your own particular tastes and interpretation. So we have one recommendation for the highbrow types out there, you literary types, and another for people who maybe want a little easier time of it, a lowbrow beach romp. And here to tell us about these books is Michael Silverblatt, host of KCRW's Bookworm. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. I'm so happy to be here.
I am more than happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's start high.
You got it.
Okay. So
I'm high.
Excellent. All right. This is a new novel by Indian author Arundhati Roy. It's called The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. And this is her first novel since she won the Booker Prize 20 years ago.
20 years ago, 8 million copies sold later.
Of The God of Small Things.
Of The God of Small Things.
So lots of expectations for this one.
Enormous. Also, most of the Indian writers publish a book and then move to England, or like Salman Rushdie, to America. Arundhati has been living in India, and the book is a thinking through of what's going on, what's been going on in India for the last 20 years.
Politically, culturally,
exactly.
Economically.
She hasn't left. She's speaking from the home and from the heart. and she's an active political person. So we're reading someone who really cares. She's not explaining India to us. She's taking us in. She's immersing us in India. And that's what's so exciting about this book. You're going to be in Kashmir. You're going to understand more about the divisions and the divisions of the divisions and why India has become the most tumultuous place in the world.
Now, you interviewed her about this book, and she dedicated it to, she writes, the unconsoled. What did she mean by that?
I think she meant a lot of things. The book is the strangest thing. What's exciting is that there are two complete sets of characters, neither of whom come to the ministry of utmost happiness, because utmost happiness is not available in our life. Mm. But she's seeing a future in which transgendered people of all kinds are emerging from within Indian culture and society.
And that's one of the characters.
That's one of the characters and whole groups.
And her world.
Her world of transgendered, transvestite. She's the future. Hmm. And then we get another set of characters who are the past. You know, the dark India that can't be settled. Those are really the unconsoled. And in this book, they're going to come to live in a cemetery, which has turned into a guest house for the lost people, people who no longer have a place to be. India is now, you know, a country that's sending its population elsewhere to live. If they're not wanted, this is a place, this cemetery becomes a place for the unwanted.
And then what about the other narrative strand? Who's at the center of that in this novel?
At the center of that is a woman, very canny, very sexual, very aware, conscious. Her name is Tilo. And she has three suitors. One of them is a politician, one of them is a journalist, and one of them is a kind of avant-garde guy. She's at the center of culture, politics, and journalism, and she is failing to succeed in every area, because success, as Arundhati said to me, success isn't available.
Everybody's supposed to want the same things. Everybody's supposed to have the same prescription for what progress, civilization, happiness is, success is. And more people are being left out of that system, that pipeline.
You know, this is a world in which you're dealing with a centralized culture that is saying if you're different, you're out.
Does she see herself in Tilo? Was Tilo modeled on her?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but at the same time, Arundhati was very firm in saying this is a novel. This is a novel. This isn't history. This isn't autobiography. This is a book that she wants her readers to really delve into. She said the way readers delve into Joyce's Ulysses.
I didn't write it thinking about what readers want or don't want, but it is my experience. We have spent our lives reading Joyce and Jane Austen, and we don't want them to water down their work for us. I don't think readers would want me to turn this into a tour guide for them. They are armed and they'll understand.
You're going to be at the center of an India you don't know, that you're going to learn about as you read. She is really, really spending time making you feel what it's like to live in modern India, especially in Delhi.
And so how would you compare it to The God of Small Things?
The God of Small Things is a winsome book that people can like easily. This is a book that's going to make demands on you. The most exciting demand is that she says that she exchanges foreground and background repeatedly. The characters you thought were the center of the book recede, and a new set of characters come. You expect the old ones to come back, but they come back in surprising ways when you don't expect them. Mm. It's an original shape for a novel, too. If a novel is both its story and its style, she's invented a way of telling this novel that's very new and very alive.
Sounds like a great book to read, and maybe you need to pay more attention to it than just sitting on a beach and, I don't know, falling asleep and napping. We have another book, however, that maybe you could nap a little bit as you're reading. This one is called Fly Me. It's by Daniel Riley, senior editor at GQ. It's set on the beaches of L.A. in 1972. This sounds like an summer beach book.
It's sort of amazing. It's a beach book that actually takes place on the beach, a lot of it. Not only does it take place on the beach, it takes place in a rewritten version of Manhattan Beach, Sela del Mar. It's a community full of beach types, in particularly the stewardesses, the stews,
as and that's when they were called stewardesses and not flight attendants.
Right, they were called stewardesses, and they referred to each other as stews. And the center of the book is a woman named Susie who has graduated from Vassar and Yale. Vassar was a sister college. Yale was not yet co-ed. It's only in her senior year that she gets to take courses at Yale, and she realizes that she's been being treated as a woman at Vassar and as a student at Yale. And she doesn't do well in physics. She gets C's for the first time in her classes, and it frightens her. So she decides to join her sister and become a stewardess. She goes to flight school. She moves to Southern California. This is someone going from Yale to the beach. And at first, I didn't know, Madeline. I didn't know why I was spending so much time on her background. The thing about this book, Fly Me, by Daniel Riley, is that it's got a final 50 pages that knocked my shoes off. I wasn't expecting any of it. Now, I have to confess to you, the bookworm doesn't read many thrillers. Maybe other people know what to expect. I felt like I was being filled with 350 pages of information I didn't know what to do with. Jim Jones is hanging out on the beach distributing his people.
The cult leader.
Distributing flyers. One of Manson's acolytes lives there. I mean, you're getting 1972 down your throat. And finally, in the last 50 pages, everything gets used. The surprises in the last 50 pages made the whole book exciting to me, and I think that's why people read thrillers. I don't like to be kept waiting.
The bookworm is impatient.
I am impatient. Yeah, because I want to be excited page by page. Mm. I don't want to be waiting.
So are you saying that before the last 50 pages, it's kind of boring? Is that what you're saying?
It's not so much boring. None of it's boring. It's too well written. It's just not telling you where it's going to go. We're getting
There's a lot of, as they say in the movie biz, laying of pipe.
Laying of pipe. Wow, that's great. That's absolutely true. And what we're hearing about plane jackings. And we know something's going to happen. Something's going to happen to someone. But we don't know when or to who or why. And everything turns into a huge romp, enormous surprise. This woman at the center of the book is a brilliant Vassar Yale stewardess for a reason. Mm. She's capable
and dare
of anything.
Dare I suggest that her chemistry knowledge will come back to help her?
In many ways, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. I don't want to, we don't want to give away. She will redeem the whole book. I mean, she's a very exciting heroine, and she's stepping forward in her own sense from the woman from Vassar to a brilliant woman of the liberated generation. In fact, she's taking liberation beyond the boundaries that you expect.
So interesting that you think, I mean, when I looked at that book, I thought, oh, this is just going to be kind of a, I don't know, an exploitative, sexist-ish book about female stewardesses. But
you know,
it's not
from
what you're
saying. It really is not. Here's what there isn't in the book. There isn't exploitative sex in the book. There's hardly sex at all. If you want your beach books to be full of sex, there's full of flirting in this book, but not sex, not physical sex. If that's what you read a summer book for, this isn't the one. Fly Me has that implication,
yeah.
But it's not what this book is.
Okay. So maybe go back to your old 70s Sidney Sheldons for that.
Yes, if you want that, there are writers who specialize in it.
Michael Silverblatt, host of KCRW's Bookworm. You can hear the Bookworm's interview with Indian author Arundhati Roy next week. Thank you very much, Michael.
It's always a pleasure, and I love reading during the summer with you, Madeline.
Coming up on the program, the sperm donation business is largely unregulated, meaning some donors are dads to dozens of children. Some of those children are now meeting each other. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's like The Handmaid's Tale for men. That's how Jacqueline Moroz describes clicking through the profiles of sperm donors on the California Cryobank website. Her sister was looking for the perfect specimen. But what Jacqueline discovered as she began researching sperm donors is that a lot of women choose the same perfect specimens, meaning some donors can be the biological fathers to scores of children. One guy, a tall, athletic blonde, has at least 150 children. Jacqueline Moroz wrote about him and his family, if you can call it that, in her new book, Scattered Seeds in Search of Family and Identity in the Sperm Donor Generation. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, tell us more about this donor. He's identified as B155A.
What we know about him is he was 6'2", blue-eyed. Both his parents and grandparents are alive. He was an economics major, very athletic. He played rugby. He likes lasagna and the color green.
That's in his profile?
Yeah. And he donated because he wanted to help others.
And we still don't actually know who donor B155A is.
No, he was an anonymous donor. And at one point, the group did hire a private detective, and they were trying to find him. And then I think it got a little bit weird. There was one woman who had this fantasy that when she met him, they were going to get married. And I think the other parents thought that was kind of strange, and then they decided to just forget about it. As far as I know, he doesn't know that he has all these children.
So apparently, at least 150 women liked that description and decided to buy his sperm?
Right.
How did find out about each other?
Well, there's a website called the Donor Sibling Registry. Each sperm donor gets an identifying number. You could put in that number, and you could connect with other families who've used the same sperm donor.
Ah, okay. And that actually is an interesting story in and of itself, the registry, because it was started by the child of a sperm donor and his mom, right?
Right. Ryan Kramer was born through a sperm donor, and he was very curious about finding any half-siblings he might have and his donor. And so in order to help him, his mother first they started, I think it was a Yahoo group, and that became so popular that it became the Donor Sibling Registry. And eventually, Brian was able to find his biological father.
Well, what does motivate the men to donate? Do they make a lot of money? Is that the prime motivation?
Yeah, they could make up to $1,500 a month.
And how many times are they donating?
So if you're a college student, that's about three times a week.
Three times a week?
Yeah.
That's a lot of sperm.
It is.
I mean, to say obvious, but that's a lot of potential children that they're...
It is.
They're sort of could be producing.
And each... The sperm banks don't really talk about this, but each donation is then divided into, it could be between 8 and 25 vials, and those are all sold off individually. So theoretically, one sperm donor could have 75 children per week.
It's hard to track, though, because it hasn't been regulated, right?
And there's right. No the limit. Fertility industry is entirely unregulated in this country compared to places like England or the UK, which is strictly regulated. And so there's no tracking of donors. There's no tracking of how many children they're having or where they are, who they are. Mothers are asked to self-report back to the sperm banks and let them know when they have children. But I think it's like 20 to 40% do that. So it's very hard to keep track.
So if it's not regulated at all, how do we know that these donors are who they say they are? That they are these tall, strapping, well-educated, athletic, perfect specimens?
Well, they do have to go into the sperm banks to donate so they can tell what they look like. They have to fill out information on their families, on their health history, but it's very hard to check that, so they can easily lie about that. There was one case where it was very sad. This guy said he was a college student, and it turned out that not only was he not in college, he had schizophrenia, and he had a criminal record.
Wow.
And now the parents are suing that sperm bank over this.
But do they, you raise a good point with the schizophrenia, do they screen for diseases that could be passed on genetically?
The FDA requires sperm donors be tested for communicable and infectious diseases, but not genetic diseases. And most sperm banks generally screen for genetic diseases, for a variety of them, but not all of them. And they don't really have to. They do that on their own. So there are rare genetic diseases actually being passed on to the children through the sperm donors.
Wow. I guess there's also the possibility of incest, too, if they don't know who their siblings are.
That's right. And in places like San Francisco, where there are a lot of lesbians living there who've used sperm donors to have children, many of the mothers have taught their kids to memorize their sperm donor's number so that if they ever met a boy or girl they wanted to date, and they could make sure they weren't a half-sister or brother. Yeah.
So I can just imagine the first date. So what's your sperm donor's number?
Exactly.
You said that it's tightly regulated in Europe. Why aren't there more regulations here in the United States?
Well, there are lots of reasons. One is that there aren't that many people who are trying to get it regulated, because the families who are buying the sperm, they just want to have a baby. The doctors feel they're helping people have babies, and the sperm banks are making a lot of money. So the only ones who are really, at this point, trying to get some kind of regulation is the children who were born through sperm donors.
Now, this is really a global industry, and you describe how in Denmark, it's one of their highest exports, sperm. And so, and I guess that's because people want the sort of the Viking look, is that?
That's right. I think it's Lego, beer, and sperm are the biggest exports in Denmark. As you can imagine, their Scandinavian men tend to be tall, you know, fair hair, blue eyes. So they're very popular.
I wonder if you could tell the story of Michael Rubino. He's an artist originally from Los Angeles, and he has 18 kids that he knows of. But he actually decided, once some of them contacted him, that he would want to actually play a role in their lives and be a real father to them.
That's right. Michael is a remarkable story. And he was married and ended up, his wife couldn't have children, which just seems like a common story. strangely among sperm donors. He ended up meeting some of his kids. He just never thought he was like a family man. But when he met these kids, he just fell in love with them. One of his biological sons and son's mother ended up moving from San Diego up to L.A. And Michael started watching the boy after school because he's an artist and he didn't have a set schedule. And when the mother was looking for a new place to live, Michael suggested that the three of them move in together and they raise their son together. And he and the mother never had a romantic relationship, but they ended up raising the boy together and really worked out great. And another interesting thing is that Michael Rubino has changed his will to leave any of his belongings to his biological children.
What about legal questions of custody? Are there cases where sperm donors are on the hook financially for these children, or who want to play a larger role in their children's lives and the mothers don't want them to?
Well, there's a very well-known story with Jason Patrick, the actor, who was involved in a relationship with a woman. They split up, and then she contacted him and asked him if he would be her sperm donor. And he agreed. And so she had a little boy named Gus, and they ended up, Jason and this woman ended up getting back together for a little while. And while they got back together, Jason became attached to the little boy. They split up again. And now Jason Patrick started asking for custody of the child. And the mother said, "You were just my sperm donor. You don't have any right to have custody of this boy." Well, the courts ruled in his favor. Hmm. And now he does have custody, partial custody of him.
So are courts increasingly looking at this as a family, or defining this as a family?
I don't think so. When they do, when the sperm donors donate, they fill out paperwork that says they will not seek any kind of custody of the children, and the mothers or parents cannot ask him for money or any of that sort of thing. So there's another interesting case where there was a lesbian couple in the Midwest who decided to just do it their own way and go through Craigslist to find a sperm donor. They did find one. I guess they paid him and then had a child. The couple ended up splitting up, and one of the mothers kept the child but couldn't get a job and ended up going on welfare. And the state did some research, found out that the father was the sperm donor, but because they hadn't gone through a doctor, he lost his right to protection from having to pay child support, and now he has to pay child support for that baby.
Jacqueline Moroz is the author of Scattered Seeds, In Search of Family and Identity in the Sperm Donor Generation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback.
Yes, hello there. I'm fascinated by the idea that one sperm donor, B155A, has more than 150 biological kids running around out there in the world. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
So I wondered how people would feel about that. Octavia Book says this feels biblical. Molly Mork says, the first 8 participants of Trump Jr.'s meeting identified by the press. The other 142 come forward. I think she's kind of conflating two stories there, but it made me laugh.
That's great. Okay. Make us laugh at Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.